And thanks again to everybody who's read that's helped us open the meeting. I'll take this opportunity to welcome those that have joined us since we first started. Particular welcome to any visitors to our meeting this evening, and a massive welcome to any newcomers or anybody coming back to NA today. We hope you're going to hear something tonight that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So it does fall on me to introduce and welcome our speaker this evening. Whom I only met very recently. We've not had much of an opportunity to talk. We did have an interesting conversation the other night at the end of a meeting, which I th was fascinating. Was compelled to ask this lady if she would come along and share her experience, strengths, and hope with us, which she very kindly agreed to. So, I'm really looking forward to Rachel's story, her journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous. And so, Rachel, without further ado, the floor is yours. Please share with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. My name is Rachel and I'm an addict.
Hello, Rachel.
Hello,
Hi,
Rachel.
Rachel.
Hello,
Welcome.
everybody. Thank you
Welcome.
very much. I appreciate the welcome. I'm joining you today from the not very sunny Oregon in the United States. I live on the west coast of the United States. Oregon is about 4 hour drive from Canada, with a state below Washington State. And I live in on the east side of the main metro area here, and I've lived here for the last 26 years nearly. Before that, I lived in Arizona for 4.5 years, and before that, I was in Minnesota for a year. And so I've been in the United States since 1990, pretty much consistently. And I've had a couple of kids here and marriage that didn't work out, and I've raised those kids pretty much on my own here on the West Coast. They've now flown and grown. In fact, they live in Tennessee. That's where they both are at the moment. And that's quite a long way east of me, southeast of me. It's about it's a two time zone difference. So that's kind of where I am right now. And I am so I live on my own and with two feral cats who after living with me for nearly 3 years still won't let me touch them, but they come and visit frequently, and especially for treats. And for a job I have I teach at university, and I also have a private practice where I work with prisoners who are struggling to take responsibility for things that they've done. Most of my clients are people who've killed people either on purpose or because they were driving under the influence. And so I facilitate dialogue between them and the people who they've hurt, or the survivors of people they've hurt, and try to when that's not possible, try to help them kind of figure out their lives from here on. So that's the, all that's that. And before I came to the United States, I was in England, and that's where I was born, and I grew up there, mostly in London. And I come from a family where addiction is rife. Both my grandfathers were addicts. My parents grew up in addict homes, albeit in the kind of upper classes. So they were very insulated from some of the effects of that, but not from absent fathers who were very unpredictable when they were there. Neither of my parents used, although they certainly have addict tendencies and other sort of family disease type symptoms. And I have two younger brothers. All three of us are addicts. All three of us are in recovery. And 2 years ago, we got to celebrate 100 years of recovery between us. My middle brother got clean first, and in 1984, I got clean in 1985, and our younger brother got clean in 1987. That's kind of, I guess, my home group. Sort of a pun that my home group is my brothers. And I'm really grateful that all of us are still here. My parents are still living. In fact, I was talking with them just before I came on here. I talk to them every Saturday. They're farmers in Suffolk in England. And so family, my family life now is a lot different than it was then. My parents were very unprepared to be parents and had all sorts of ideas about how children should behave, which wasn't, most of those expectations were, shall I put it, disappointed by the three children they actually had. And all of us started using pretty young. I think I was probably the youngest. I was about 10 when I started using prescription medications, which, first of all, I was using my own prescriptions and abusing those. And then I started stealing my dad's. I started using alcohol when I was about 12. And I really, I was a kind of a loner person. And I didn't want to have to depend on anybody else for my supply. And so I didn't find the kind of illegal drug culture at all attractive. So I used legal things illegally. I did a bit of dope smoking, and when I went traveling, I went off and did a kind of hippie thing in India, and I certainly used while I was there, but I pretty much didn't in England. And by the time I was 19, I knew I was in trouble with it. I could not stop when I got started. I ended up in places that where I would come to some time later. Not always sure how long later, and I didn't always know who I was with, and I didn't always know where I was or how to get home from there. And all of that was sufficiently alarming that I really was trying to stop by the time I was about 19, and became a sort of periodic user. Allowed me to navigate university and a teaching qualification, and then I got clean in my first year of teaching because I was completely out of control. And if I used on Friday night, I couldn't go to work on Monday. So I was using very intermittently by then, but constantly preoccupied by wanting to use and talking to people who weren't there and unable to manage any of the kind of adulting that is necessary once you're actually being paid and you're living in an apartment, in a flat where you have to pay rent and all of those things. I just couldn't cope with any of that stuff. And I thought I was crazy. And so I was 24 when my brother went into treatment, my younger brother went into treatment. He was 22. And he was in the States, living in the States, and he'd come back for a visit and told me and my youngest brother that he was using cocaine. But he'd got it handled, he was fine, and then he just wasn't fine anyway. And he ended up in treatment, and his insurance allowed him to bring a family member to like a family week. And my parents went the first time, and his insurance allowed him to take another family member 3 months later. And he asked me if I would go with him. So I got on a plane to go to come to the States. I was working in London at the time, and I got on a plane. I thought it'd be kind of in poor taste to show up wasted, so I didn't use anything. And I arrived, and we went to this treatment thing, and it was wild. I couldn't, I mean, everything people said spoke about our home life as children and the relationship that our parents had with each other, the sort of unpredictability of life, the terrible loneliness, and the feelings of being apart and not belonging and all those things that I had felt all my life. And it really was creepy. It was like somebody, I don't know, somebody had been in my house or something. I felt almost violated by how well these descriptions were working. And, you know, at the same time as it was creepy and scary, it was also hopeful because maybe I wasn't actually crazy, maybe I was just an addict. And I was confronted. I made it about 2.5 days before somebody confronted me on that, on and during that week. And I remember my brother and I sitting in a car in the car park of the treatment facility, and he was looking at me saying, do you think you could be? You know, we hadn't lived together for a long time. We both went to boarding school, so we hadn't spent a lot of time with each other since we were in our early teens. And I'm like, I don't know. Do you think I could be? You know, he asked me about my using, and he said, well, I don't know, maybe you could be. And at the time, he was in AA, and so he took me and he bought me an AA big book, and I read it on the plane on the way home, and I decided I was going to be clean for a year. And if I had a problem with that, then maybe I had a problem. And I knew I was going to have a problem with that. I felt like the earth was opening up underneath my feet with the idea that I wasn't going to use for a year. I mean, who doesn't use for a year? That's just nuts. Everybody uses, I thought. And my life became completely chaotic during that year. And the day I made the decision that I was going to do that year was the 11th of April 1985, and I have not had to use intoxicating chemicals since then. I didn't make the decision I was going to stay stopped until nearly a year later, when I realized that unless I was really understood that I was an addict, I was going to use again. And I'd been going to the other fellowship, and I didn't know anything about NA really. My brother was going to NA by then, and he talked about it a little bit, but I think we were both still pretty focused on the drug, you know. And it wasn't until I had about 2.5 years and I decided to stop smoking cigarettes. And I was by that time I had come over to the United States to do a degree and hang out with my brother a bit. I had a sabbatical from my job in London, and I decided I was going to stop smoking. And the people in the AA meeting that I was going to told me it was an outside issue. I couldn't talk about it there. And my brother said, "Go to NA. They'll let you talk about it." Well, I can't go to NA. It's not narcotics. And he said, "Doesn't matter. A drug is a drug is a drug. You get to go and be in NA." And you know, I heard it again read in the readings tonight, you know, alcohol is drug. And I went to a newcomers meeting in NA, and everybody else there was smoking. And when I said I was trying to stop smoking, they were like, "Yeah, great, that's terrific." And I was like so amazed that people totally got it. And I heard in those early meetings about the disease of addiction, and that changed the game for me. Completely changed the game. The first step of NA just changed the game. And today I was reading a Just for Today about the tool of writing, and I was thinking about, you know, how has writing made a difference? How have I used that as a tool? And I use it all the time in my recovery. And that was the, you know, but that I had already done, I think, 5 steps by then. But writing about addiction suddenly pulled together my life. Suddenly, a whole bunch of things made sense. I was no longer writing about the increasingly distant past. I was writing about today. You know, when I write about the disease of addiction, I can still write about today. You know, in any given day, I have multiple, you know, decisions, as anyone does who's living life. You have to decide whether you're going to get up or stay in bed. You have to decide whether or not you're actually going to go to work or call in sick. You have to decide whether you're going to eat a balanced meal or you're going to eat what you feel like eating. And so, in any given day, there are multiple decisions that I can make where I can make a choice to be in recovery and move my recovery forward, or I can make a choice to, I think, standing still. But actually, what it does is it just increases the lack of tone in my spiritual muscles to make those decisions. And that is my addiction, that compulsion, the self-centeredness, the obsession, all of that stuff is in my day-to-day, even with a lot of years of recovery now. So addiction, the concept of addiction keeps it clean and keeps it green for me, of what life is like as an addict. And I, when I think of myself as being dependent on a particular drug, that's a long time ago, and I'm not anymore. And it really doesn't feel relevant to me anymore. And it's an identity, if you like, that I can easily sort of slough off and feel isn't important. Like, it's easy for me to become complacent. But when I think of myself as an addict, it's like today, already it's only 10:30 in the morning for me, and already it's like, yeah, there's choices that I've had opportunities to make certain choices, and today so far, the decision points that have been salient, I've made the decision to be in recovery. And so it, as I say, it keeps it current. It is a recommitting each day to be a recovering addict, not a practicing addict. So I started coming to NA when I had about 2.5 years, actually, off intoxicating chemicals, and I was really committed in NA. I got involved in service. I got involved in group level service and area level service. I got married to somebody else who was in recovery in the States. Then we moved to England, and while we were in England, he became really involved in regional service and then in world service. And so I was sort of tagging along for the ride. I didn't hold service positions at that level myself, but he represented the UK to the World Service Conference, and during the time that we were there, and so I got to spend time with the conference agenda report and learning about NA and how NA worked, sort of how the service structure worked. And NA is so inclusive, and actually even collaborative in that way, that every single one of us is invited into that service structure to the extent we want to be involved. And at the time, there was a lot of conversation about the literature. There was conversation about translation of the literature, and there was a conversation about whether or not NA needed a book about the 12 steps and 12 traditions. And a year or so later, I was part of the groups that met all over the world to write what they knew about certain steps and send it in, and some of that stuff is recognizably in the Green and Gold, and that was very exciting. It felt very direct, and that, we were really involved, and there was a point to being involved. Our voices really were being heard, and that was very different than the experience I'd had in other fellowship. And there was lots about it. It was magnetic and exciting, and there were lots of young people around, and a lot of those young people had been clean a long time. That was something else that was very different for me. So a relatively young person in the other fellowship, where I could sit in a room and people who had the same amount of time as me were 20 or 30 years older than I was. That wasn't true in NA, and so I got to be with people who were been around as long or longer than I had been, who were my age, and were doing the same things in their lives that I was doing. And so I had real companionship, there really was a sense of fellowship, and that fellowship ran deep. You know, I have been fortunate enough during COVID to reconnect with people that I was clean with before I moved to where I am now, and to go to meetings with them again. And it's been just great to experience that sort of the invigoration and the excitement. The excitement. There was so much change. There was a lot of change in NA. We, you know, there's a lot more literature was sort of coming out. We had the Green and Gold, and then the workbook came out, and just the tools were sort of gathering, and we were getting more and more of a sense of an international fellowship. While I was in England, there was a whole conversation about the UK service office, and you know how were different branches of the fellowship going to stay connected with each other when they were operating in different languages. And it was just really a vital time. And then in my domestic life, I was, you know, I had moved to Minnesota first, and then to Arizona to pursue another degree, and got very involved with other people in the program there, and then we moved up to Oregon, and neither of us knew anybody here, and we also had a young child, and suddenly things were different. You know, we'd both been around a while. My husband had been around a bit longer than me, so I don't know. We moved up in here in '95, so I had about 10 and a half years, and my husband had about 12 years, I guess. So, you know, it was kind of easy to be a bit complacent about getting connected here. Plus, we had a little kid, and we, you know, the sort of bridge to normal living, I think we both of us were kind of distracted with all the different things that we were doing with people who weren't addicts by then. And it was a lot more difficult to get connected, and things were very difficult in our marriage at that point. And unfortunately, my husband became ill with some mental illness things that really, in the end, made our lives completely impossible. I miscarried a baby. It was the second baby we'd had that had not, in the end, been born. Our first child was stillborn. Then we had our second child. Then the third child died as well. And that was a tremendous blow to both of us. And my husband got into a very severe depression at that point, and which our marriage just didn't recover from. We had another child, and my husband left. And so at that point, I had two small children. The law in the United States was that I could not bring them back to England, nor could I move further than 60 miles away from their father. We didn't have any family support at all. Neither one of us had really made a lot of contact with people in the program by then. And it became just really difficult for me to manage all the sort of time commitments to the children and go to meetings. And I wanted to continue going to NA, but it just was, there weren't NA meetings in the mornings. Taking my children to meetings in the evening just totally didn't work. Kids were so restless and took so much of my attention, it just nearly drove me nuts. And I, as I say, I guess I was kind of complacent. It was like, it's all right. You know, this is just a season. It won't last long, I thought. And there were meetings that were more accessible in another fellowship. And then I had to move out of the main metro area because I couldn't afford to live there. And that made it even more difficult because I was working from home, and the commute to NA meetings was long. And I just couldn't afford to spend that much time going to meetings. And I, in the end, bought a house that was on the other side of the road from daily meetings in another program, and I went to that instead. And it was interesting because I didn't ever attach. I didn't. I mean, it was kind of the second. I was reading NA literature still, but of course I wasn't sponsoring because I wasn't meeting people, and I didn't have an NA sponsor. I don't really have a sponsor, but I was still reading the literature and writing, and it was at the beginning of COVID. My son came home, decided he and my daughter both decided I was sort of not competent to live on my own in the pandemic, so they both came home for a few months to just sort of check on me and make sure I was okay. My son was here only about a week when he said to me, "You know, Mom, I just want to say that this physical distancing thing has made no difference to your social isolation." It was such a wake-up call for me that my son could see that. And almost at the same time, a guy I knew from the Brixton meeting in South London, which was the meeting I had attended physically when I lived in England, reached out to me and said that UK was celebrating 40 years of NA and I should join the Facebook group. And then he also said, "And Brixton's on Zoom." And that was just like such a wild thing. It was right around my 35th anniversary, and it was overwhelming, the idea that I could go back to Brixton and I could go to meetings there with those people. Of course, most of the people who I used to go to meetings with there no longer attend that meeting, but a lot of them are still clean. And I reconnected with most of them, and I've been attending that meeting for ever since, and took a service position there. And then I thought, well, I wonder who else is on Zoom. And so I contacted friends in Arizona and friends in Minnesota, and I've been attending meetings in those places. And oh man, it's just been like incredibly amazing to come home. And the fantastic books that have been published in NA since I was really here, and really enjoying reading my way through Living Clean and the Guiding Principles, and having book study groups with old friends again, because we can do it on Zoom. You know, the fact that we're geographically dispersed doesn't have to mean that we can't be in fellowship with each other. And then as reopening is starting, and you know, realizing that those meetings are not going to be available to me indefinitely, and not wanting to be in the same position that I was in a bit over a year ago now, I've started to connect with people who are local to where I live. You know, and I haven't reconnected with people that I knew in NA when I first came here. I haven't found those people, so I don't know where they go to meetings now or whether they're still clean. But it is really so amazing. I feel so grateful to be firmly rooted again, not just in my program, but also in the fellowship. I think I really hadn't understood about fellowship until pretty recently, and how important that was, because it had been so easy. You know, it was so easy for me in the first 10 years of my recovery, and then it wasn't. And I just kind of thought it didn't matter somehow. I don't know. I was so preoccupied with getting these kids raised and, you know, being an adequate parent for them. I wasn't thinking very hard about what I needed. And it is, I guess, you know, one of the things that I feel is important about what I can say is that after you've been around a while, it is very easy to, you know, you don't look desperate to anyone else, so people don't reach out to you the way that they did when you were new. And it's very easy to not quite know how to fit in, because there are people who have the time, you know, have similar time, already have their friend groups who they've been hanging out with for a long time, and it's just really easy to not quite get connected. Especially when you move to a new place. So that's my experience of that. And to think, I think I'm not alone in this, to think, oh, I'm okay. I'm not using, it's all right, I'm not going to use, and I didn't think about using that whole time. But I didn't have a close friend, I didn't have people who could call me out. I didn't have, except obviously my son. For me, the literature has been really important this year. I'm working my way through the step working guide because I didn't ever do that myself. I sponsored other people through it, but by the time it came on the scene, it was a long time since I had done my steps. I'm finding it interesting and helpful. I'm really grateful to be back in the, sort of back in the literature with more support, with people around me who I can really talk to. I don't have to translate it. And I'm enjoying that. I'm loving being at meetings, and I'm going to a lot and have enjoyed the reconnection with people who speak like I do and understand my jokes. It's just been an amazing year, and I am so grateful for it. It's sort of been the boost, sort of a much needed boost, and one that I didn't recognize that I needed in my recovery. So it's been a renewal, a sort of renewing my vows, if you like, to be in recovery and to explore what that can mean for me at this point in my life. I've been clean 36 years. I didn't think that I would be alive even, and I probably wouldn't have been alive another 2 years. I had no intention of being alive in my 30s. I didn't want anything to do with and want any of those things. I didn't want to be an adult. And here I am, 61, looking at, wow, I might actually retire. I might like have a retirement in recovery. What would that look like? I mean, it's just unimaginable. It's completely unimaginable. And I'm so grateful to still be here. Inevitably, over the last year, I've thought about the people who aren't still here and all those amazing people who accompanied me and were in my fellowship when I was early on, who are not here anymore. And, the still suffering addict too. And my former husband is one of those. And, he's still living, but he's very isolated, and I don't know if he's going to meetings. We've had no contact for nearly 12 years now, except through what I hear from his family. And it's pitiful and it's sad because he was so engaged and so involved and excited by recovery. And I don't know what happened. And it's salutary to hear that and humbling. Like, I don't know why me, and I don't believe that my higher power has chosen me over him, but I or over the others who aren't here at all. But I am incredibly grateful to be here, and I feel very motivated to do what it will take for me to stay, because this is a really good life. And so for anyone who hasn't been around for a long time, I just welcome you here, and I hope that I've said something that will encourage you to stay. Life is hard. It is hard, and but it's harder when you're using. And when you do it in recovery, in fellowship, with a program, it's still hard, but it's doable. And then you can get through it. You can get through stuff, and there is another side. And then the next thing will come, but there's company, people who know your life, and that's an extraordinary thing. And the longer I've been around, the more I appreciate that. And the people who love me, not in spite of what's happened, but because of what's happened, because they know. So I think that's all I'm going to say for now. Thank you very much indeed for inviting me and for letting me share.